I am the intro.
You are the intro, the outro, the extra, and everything in between.
So what are your plans for this week coming up?
My plans for this week are, let's see, tomorrow I'm going up to Madison, Wisconsin.
Whoa.
With Drezel and another friend of mine named Sarah. We're going to go up there, and Drezel is participating in the Pokemon Regional Championships for the video game. So we're going to go up there and cheer him on.
That's kick ass.
It is.
So is this for, it's not Sun and Moon isn't the latest one. Is it? Wait, hang on.
It's whatever the latest one is.
I'm curious, like, I got to talk with Drezel a bit more because, like, I think I've mentioned in the past, a buddy and I, we used to do Pokemon video game semi-competitively as well. And we would, like, tutor up on Smogon University and we'd spend hours researching, like, strategies and stuff like that. I'm genuinely curious to, like, chat with him about, like, actual tournaments, not just, like, the hobbyist tournaments.
Yeah, you should. He knows quite a bit about it. He's spent probably 60 man hours, I kid you not, preparing his team for this competition. And he tweaks it every time. He goes all out.
One future episode we could have post, post-tournament, if Drezel would like to be on the show, is we could have like a childhood games like episode.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because I mean, it especially in Relay with like how it is growing up, you know, seeing the changes of the internet over time, seeing the changes in like our favorite games as they've aged, and just, you know, stuff we did when we were kids.
I know Drezel would love to be part of that. He's got lots of experience like me when growing up, but he went way into gaming even more hardcore than I did, so I'm sure he's got many of opinions. And then after that, because that's only a weekend thing, so I'll be back Sunday night, early Monday. And then on Tuesday I'm going to Washington D.C. with my parents and my little brother.
Nice.
Yeah, we're going to go take the tour, check out Congress, go to the Smithsonian Museums, and just, you know, take it all in because I've never been there before with my family.
Get a real bite of American history.
Yep. What's funny is I've been to the Australian capital, Canberra, and I actually toured their Parliament House and their museum and of their national history and whatnot. And I found it fascinating, and then I started to think about it because my family was trying to figure out where to go for our annual family get-together. And I said, you know, we should do the capital of the U.S. We kind of are Americans. We live here. We should experience this at least once. And they all were on board, so this is going to be fun.
Yeah, nice.
Ever been?
No, I have not. My sister lives over in Virginia, and I want to go visit her while she's still living over there at some point. But no, I haven't actually been over to the East Coast easily in over 10 years. And the furthest, the most I've ever done on the East Coast is Florida. Like, I never went further north than that.
What'd you do in Florida?
I had an aunt that lived there, as well as Disney World.
That's immediately what I was thinking, was Disney World.
Yeah, pretty much the only reason to go to Florida, for real, is Disney World.
Yeah, you know, Universal Studios, Orlando in general. But yeah, well, they do call Florida God's waiting room for a reason.
I was more or less thinking just the insane drugs they got going on down there. It's really not that great when you leave the populated areas.
No, it's not at all.
Unfortunately. Plus alligators.
Yeah, I had a friend of the family move down there from Tennessee, and they moved back to Tennessee 3 years later because she got tired of opening up her front door and having gigantic snakes and alligators just all over her front yard. Literally, that was it. She was done.
My aunt, yeah. Her biggest issue was frogs, like the spawning season. Like her walls would just be covered in frogs because apparently they like stucco. It's easy for them to grip onto or something. So
yeah,
she would have to get power washings every single year just to get rid of like the frog excrement buildup on the walls.
That sounds disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, so going back to alligators really quick, one of my plans for this week, hopefully this week, is my hyena and I, we like to go around and we like to try more exotic meats and stuff.
Right.
So we were going to try to track down some alligator meat and see if we could find like a store here that imports that.
Do you have a Bass Pro Shop or Cabela's near you?
Bass Pro Shop is largely an East Coast thing. Cabela's we do have, but they don't have gator meat. They have ostrich meat, they have deer meat, elk meat, venison, that whole thing, but they don't have, like, reptiles.
Well, okay. Well, when you come to my neck of the woods one day, I'll take you to the restaurant at my Bass Pro Shops, and they have every kind of weird meat you can think of and an actual chef cooking. It's really cool.
There is one restaurant / meat market here that we're going to go check out hopefully today, definitely by Saturday, that should have alligator meat as well as a few other exotics we want to pick up. Have you ever had buffalo? Bison?
Once.
Okay, that's definitely a more popular meat around here. We actually have a buffalo farmer probably less than a mile away from my house. He has bison, he has elk, and he'll prep the meat and sell them to the local stores. So it's actually a lot easier to get bison meat and stuff where I live.
I believe bison meat is actually leaner, a little healthier for you. And when I remember tasting it, it had a very distinct taste, but because I had a bison burger.
Right.
But it was seasoned very well, and I ended up eating the whole thing because I was afraid I might not like this. But I ended up this is different but tasty.
It's different in a familiar way, whereas like you bite into it kind of expecting this burgery, like more of a steak texture instead of a burger. More flavorful too, in a good way. Like it's not pungent or like anything. It just has a really good flavor to it.
Well, speaking of meat, have you ever had the chance to try Kobe beef versus just regular beef?
I have not had the chance to try Kobe beef yet.
Okay. My opinion, if you buy a good quality cut of regular beef you can find at your local supermarket or butcher shop, and you bought a piece of Kobe beef and you cook them the same exact way, I'm of the opinion you'd be hard-pressed to taste the difference. I think it's just a lot of marketing bullshit. I'm all for treating cows well, but at the end of the day, I
wouldn't be surprised if you're actually kind of a little more on the nose there with that. There are places that sell Kobe beef around here, and I think that's part of the reason why I haven't done it is because it's more of an indulgent thing versus a new experience thing. But at some point, I'll probably give it a try and rate it.
Okay. So, ready to get this show on the road?
Yeah. So, we touched on it, and then we diverted off onto meat topics because me, and I'm sorry. But we were going to talk about, like, the classic internet.
Right. Are we actually recording?
Yes, we have been.
I figured that, but just doesn't hurt to ask. yeah, you know, we can talk about a little bit of everything on this show. Good Lord. So, yes, classic internet culture.
What was your first experience? Actually, we should probably do the intro because we forgot that the past 2 weeks now. Should we do the intro? Do you want to do the intro?
What's the episode number?
This is episode 88 of Bird Life. I'm Core.
I'm Storm.
Our eagle hearts beats pointed up with pride, we cry. Horizon ahead, wings spread out, we claim the sky. Badania, Badania, all glory to Badania. Badania, Badania, forever free Badania. Badania, Badania, all glory to Badania. Badania, Badania, forever free Badania. Beeping.
And that gap in between where I introduce myself and Storm introduced himself is where Fleeks would normally introduce himself, but he's not here today. He has overexerted himself and is promptly passed out. So it's just us. And we're talking about meat and internet.
That's right. Fleeks is currently sleeping below the studio, and we're letting him rest in his nest because Lord knows he needs it. So we're talking about meat and the internet. Somehow they go hand in hand. I don't know, but
you
that's
can
the
order
buck
meat
of 2018.
On the internet.
And it'll be delivered to your door.
Yes.
That's right. I have
what
done that.
Age.
I have actually done that before. You could save some money depending where you go. But my first introduction to internet culture was when I was 6 or 7 years old. I was on my first computer on America Online, and I went on to a chat room for the very first time through AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh boy.
And it was and honestly, the internet back then was kind of new to everyone. So people back then, kids my age even, it was a lot more polite. They actually used full words. We carried a conversation. We were generally interested in talking to each other.
Yeah.
When you compare that fast forward to, say, Facebook today, this is what I'll start off with, is the way we talk to each other online from the 90s versus now when I first started has changed. And the culture of social networking today through Facebook and other online chats seems to be less, let me get to know you, let's debate, or let's talk about this idea, and more so just looking for people to reinforce your own beliefs and your own concepts, and if they don't align, well, you know, fuck them, they're assholes.
Yeah,
and
that, I think that's kind of a bit of an extreme side of it. More or less what I personally can see today happening is versus the 90s. Back in the 90s, it was, yes, I want to get to know you. How's it going? Let's chat. But moving forward more today, it's more about self-promotion and self-advertisement. So people are not looking to get to know others as they are. They're looking to try to get others to get to know them. It's a much more selfish variant of it. And hand-in-hand with that does go the more extreme, like, I want to find only people who align with my beliefs. I want to only find people who think the way I think. And that's a very narrow way of living your life.
Agreed. And it really started to go that way through Facebook, in my opinion. Yes, there's been chats and other things where people were acting this way to an extent before. But when you went on Facebook and you went on, say, YouTube as well, when YouTube got started and people started really promoting themselves as their own brand, getting likes and getting followers became more important than just engaging in a humanistic way.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest distinction of internet culture I've seen between the 90s and now, just from a social standpoint. And it's something that really, that's really kind of sad. I think it's doing harm to our society in a way, but not as much harm as the just the amount of bullshit you can find online. I don't care what the topic is. It could be politics. It could be health advice, cooking recipes, car insurance, whatever it may be.
Just trying to eating things.
Exactly. Trying to find.
It's adorable.
Oh, God. Trying to find relevant factual information online that you can trust is not that easy, especially if you're not tech savvy and you know how to look at sources and cross-reference, etc. If you're just the average Joe, you hop online, you do a Google search, you really don't fucking know if you're getting the truth or not from a lot of these results that first pop up. It's, or,
as you said, with Facebook as well, just people saying things and then people taking it at face value and believing it.
Oh, I don't believe anything on Facebook anymore. I'm sorry. It's
me neither, but so many do. So many people out of our generation, younger or older, who have not quite made the connection yet that people lie, just seem to take whatever they hear on Facebook as full-on fact, as just the truth.
Yeah, you know? Like how many times, I have lost count of how many times this year, for example, on Facebook from my own family's feed that follows me on Facebook. How many times the vaccines cause autism misinformation has gotten posted and reposted and reposted. And it's like the doctor that made that study was debunked. He lost his medical license. It's bullshit. It's been proven to be bullshit. Here's all these official government and hospital-related sources telling you it's bullshit. You are entitled to believe whatever you like, but at least have decent sources. And it's over and over and over. But I think that's indicative of the world we live in today. And
that's exactly what happened, is one doctor, he questioned it. He said, I wonder if vaccines are linked to the increased rate of autism. So he started his own study. His study was not a good study. It was not using a very large pool. It was not using very... It was... So when you're doing research, you know, you try to find where a path leads. His method of trying to find, like, the link between autism and vaccines was trying to forge that link. Like, okay, we have the result, which is autism, and the cause is vaccine. Let's find the evidence to connect those two. Instead of the, you know, appropriate way of doing it via the scientific method and research and study groups and pools. So his research was debunked for that. And because it was such a large... Because it got so much attention, that's what caused him to lose his medical license. But even after he lost his medical license, a famous author, and I don't remember her name right now, took all his research and basically republished it in her own work as a charity organization. Her endeavors are a charity organization, so she would publish it and use her own reputation to hype it up to the extent that it has become. Let me get her name pulled up here really quick.
Sure. And what I find even more sad is when you go online and you go into people that only want to buy into this line of thinking, you know, there's other communities like the flat earthers and such, okay? There's all these different communities that are scientifically debunked, but people still really are passionate about it. So when you get into this, what really bothers me is when it's medical related, like vaccines, you'll literally have people claiming to be doctors and nurses, etc., trying to give each other advice on how to get around mandatory vaccine checks at their employers, and talking about, you know, they'll pay for it, get the receipt, but not do it, and just all these other tactics to claim they've gotten protection and not. And basically, that sharing of information just goes to reinforce how the internet truly is a double-edged sword. You know, on the one hand, it's such a tremendous wealth of knowledge, and you learn from anywhere in the world, meet people from anywhere in the world. But you also can share bullshit. You can give each other's ideas and how to basically commit criminal activities. It's a double-edged sword. And our society is still trying to strike that balance. And the balance right now is still out of whack. And our generation, especially mine, is feeling the full brunt of that right now.
Yeah, there was no such thing as a quarter-life crisis 20 years ago. But now there's such a massive disconnect between generations, my generation and the generation that is only 5 years younger than me. I basically have nothing to relate to with them in many circumstances. It's really confusing because they're working on a whole different level than even I am.
Yep.
Also, yep. Just to finish off that thought from before, so the author I was thinking of was Jenny McCarthy. She's the one who took the research and twisted it to her own books and her own claim to fame. And she started an autism organization, and that's what she calls it, is an autism organization called Generation Rescue. And their statement is dedicated to improving the child's quality for children with autism. It's a sentence that doesn't even make sense. But she's gained a lot of attention and traction for it, simply because she was already pretty renowned before, and she speaks so plainly that anybody can pick up what she's saying, you know?
Sure. But, you know, it's not just vaccines, like I mentioned. You know, let's look at the Flat Earth Society. You go back 10 years, and if you say, oh, I believe that, you know, the Earth is flat, most people would kind of giggle at you and say, oh, come on, man, have you seen NASA's pictures? You know, they just kind of laugh you off. Now, it's basically become its own, like, subculture. It has conventions. And I really believe none of this would be possible, at least not as big as it is, if it wasn't for the internet, if it wasn't for Facebook. You just go and search, and oh my goodness, there's this relevant topic.
Yeah,
and
for
just
sure.
Roll with it.
And the thing is I don't have any sources to back this up, but from what I understand, the whole Flat Earth Society thing started off as a joke. A group of people were joking around, seeing if they could kind of get this thing, like this ball rolling. And then it took off out of their hands. They couldn't quite catch it after that. So that's a good example of a joke being more damaging than anybody could ever have realized.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if people are going to believe that, I'm really of the opinion, after seeing these other things online, that if you market it just right enough, make just a convincing enough video, just a convincing enough ad, people online will believe almost anything at face value. And
yeah, it's all about how you sell it.
Yeah, and you know, people want to say that there was, because of Facebook and fake profiles being set up and misleading advertising being set up, that the last election was influenced. Jury's still out on that, but I could see why they would make that argument. And I guess it leads to the question of, is our society being damaged by freedom of speech? Because the internet is allowing freedom of speech in a way that wasn't really possible before. Or, you know, because with that freedom comes a great responsibility. And the question is, do we just sit back and whatever happens, happens, because we have these rights? Or should people that make false statements, it's like, yeah, you can say whatever you want, but if you're speaking bullshit, we're going to hold you accountable for it. Is there some kind of balance? Is there some kind of balance?
Yeah.
Right. But then again, there's people that's going to argue that, you know, who determines that you're speaking bullshit? Is the government going to come down on you? Is the government going to use that to stifle people telling the truth that the politicians don't want you to hear?
Evidence-based research.
Yeah, you know, evidence-based research, absolutely, but we live in an era, Core, where, you know, we have to deal with this thing called alternative facts. So, I mean,
yep.
it's just the world we live in. You know, but moving on to other things about online, because it's not just all negative bullshit. It really isn't.
Well,
it's a wonderful mixture.
Here's where things kind of started to change, and not necessarily for the worse, because it definitely made the internet as a whole more accessible and easier to become a part of. But do you remember the whole Internet 2.0 thing? That was a large scale effort to make the internet more easily accessible in the fact of publishing your own work. And it was the changes from IRC to what we have now, to blogging platforms, to Twitter, to Facebook and all that. This massive overhaul allowed the general people to more easily publish whatever they wanted. Before that, it wasn't easy. There was no blogs. If you wanted to start a website, you either had to rent a server, which you still have to do now, but in a much less accessible way, or build your own server and work with your ISP to get all the information. And it was not nearly as streamlined and automated as we have it is now.
Yes. I remember hearing about, I remember it being called Internet 2.0, but I do remember hearing about people coming together and making a concentrated effort to make the internet more accessible. And basically it's the same thing that you just described. And for the most part, I will say that still overall, there's been more good than bad. There really has, in terms of accessibility and innovation and the ability to talk to loved ones or, you know, make a living online, whether you're an artist or a consultant, building your own brand for good reasons because you have a quality service or product to offer. All of this is great, and it's very easy to do with the internet now.
It's easy to focus on the negative, but yeah, in a more broad sense, yes, it is significantly better because now I can look on my phone and get the facts. And when I'm saying facts, I don't mean like Facebook facts. I mean like if I have a question about the origin of something, if I have a question about the integrity of a company, I can look up other people's reviews of that company. I can look up, you know, who invented the waffle and around when was that invented, and be able to get that information pulled up accurately and quickly within a matter of seconds. Versus back in the 90s, even with the internet being there, it would take a lot more effort. And Alta Vista.
I remember that. You remember Ask Jeeves?
Yes, it's still around. It's now just Ask.
Yeah, they retired Jeeves, though.
Jeeves got old and sick of people.
I miss Jeeves. I think Jeeves was kick-ass. They should bring him back.
So, Storm, I've got a question for you.
Dogpile.com. Dogpile.com is my other favorite, too. Sorry, it just popped in my head.
I was going to ask, but okay.
Holy shit, Dogpile.com still exists. I didn't know that. I just Googled it. It works.
Wow. I'm going to look this up myself. Okay, so my question is, what was your first experience with the internet?
My very, very first experience.
Your introduction experience, yes.
Going on America Online for the very first time, my mother was in the room. It was our first computer. We got one of those free AOL CDs, popped it in, registered for the first time. And
got your 30 days free.
Back then, it was only 15. That was 1996.
Ah.
So we signed up. And my first experience was after I got my own sub account going on AOL. And the first thing I did was I went to AOL Games. And they had all these cool little games you could download that people, AOL users, actually submitted. So there was like a checkers game or a little silly racing game or a block building game. And I just loved it. I loved playing these silly little games. And then you could go on the chat room for the AOL Games board. And you actually could chat about the games you were playing, and it was a nice little way to meet people and share ideas. And I was in elementary school at the time, so you got to remember, I'm just a little kid, but to me, this was freaking awesome. And that was sort of my introduction to the internet. I would play games, and then I was fascinated with the weather, so I would go online and look up when the weather was coming or if there was a tornado somewhere.
It was that was before my introduction became a thing.
You know, yeah, but it was to us, from a kid from the 90s, it was the greatest fucking thing since sliced bread that time.
Being able to play Go Fish on a computer was like mind-blowing.
Like, literally mind-blowing.
If you want to throw back to history,
or ski
on
free.
YouTube, you can Google AT&T predicts the future, okay? And it's literally this infomercial AT&T made in late 70s, early 80s about all the things they were going to bring to you in the future. And we have it all today. They called it different things, but we have, you know, an Android tablet you can read the news on. We've got a computer you can play checkers on with a guy from around the world. We have all of those things that they predicted from back then. It's fucking awesome.
So what you're saying is we should all be thanking AT&T for creating our future.
Well, no, AT&T did not create our future, but AT&T actually, you know, Ma Bell, their parent company, we have a lot to thank them for. Their research and development department, Bell Labs, really helped push through some of this innovation. Not all, but some that we enjoy today.
I think you're right, yes.
Now,
Go ahead. Okay. I was just going to say, my first experiences on the internet was probably a little later than yours, about 98, 99. And I don't know if you ever watched the show, but there was a series called Robot Wars. And it was basically Britain's version of BattleBots.
Yes. And
much
yes.
better than BattleBots, in my opinion. But
I loved it.
You know, they had their website, so obviously a very enthusiastic 8-9-year-old core wanted to go to the website and see what was on there and, you know, get to know that season's competitive bots and whatnot. So that kind of is what started it. And then I think kind of just gradually over time, I started to go to different things. Like, I really got into Metroid, and I've talked about that before. But very big game in my life. So I joined a forum probably about the time I was 10 or 11, which is a lot younger than you should allow a person to join forums, in my opinion. But I was on this forum and discussing Metroid things, and it was probably like the highlight of my life at that time because I was talking with other people who were enthusiastic about the games I was enthusiastic about, and it was great. From the forums, I was introduced to IRC, which is still around, and I actually had someone suggest to me like 3 days ago that we should do a Bird Crew IRC group, which sounds fun, but IRC is not, it hasn't changed. It's not that it's inaccessible, it's that just as a platform, there's nothing that it provides that's a distinct benefit over Telegram or what we currently have. Telegram's just a lot more easily accessible. But
I agree. Now, if they were talking about, you know, other instant messengers, I could see the appeal of IRC. But ever since Telegram really got off the ground, I really don't see the purposes of IRC anymore. It was great for its time. I remember being on the Fernet IRC. Had a lot of friends on there, and all the friends I had in there just about are on Telegram now. So if you're just using IRC, you're using it for nostalgia reasons.
Oh yeah, for
not
sure.
That there's anything wrong with that, but
even in that regard, though, like it was a lot easier to make bots for IRC and just simplistic ones that would do like whenever someone says a particular word, it replies with another particular word, or you know, if someone pings you, which it mean is the old version of private messages or, you know, at names, you in a group, whenever someone pinged you, it would actually send a notification to your desktop kind of thing, which, you know, Telegram does that all automatically now.
Correct. And IRC also worked very well on dial-up connections.
Yeah.
Because it didn't use much bandwidth.
That was the most live chat, like, available. It was instant.
Whereas, you know, I know that there's going to be people listening to this show that are going to laugh because they're of an older generation than even you and I, Core, and their first connection to the internet wasn't really the internet as we know it. It was just bulletin board systems, and you would literally log in, you would dial directly into the bulletin board system, and basically it's what we would call a form now. But back then you log on and then there's your different little chats and you'd go and you'd leave your comments. And then when you were done, you'd sign off.
And they were super, super basic.
Yeah. And some of them charged by the minute.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah.
I remember having dial-up cards for laptops that were like charged by the minute. It was usually something like 10 cents a minute was like the high end, but still.
In your opinion, Core, what do you feel the biggest change of the internet has been so far?
I think we hit a point, probably around 2009, 2010, that there was no definitive marker for change, but everything, as far as just the entire internet goes, began to accelerate. And I think it was around 2009, 2010, Facebook and Twitter really kind of started to take off as companies. So a lot more general use was happening with the internet. A lot more people who weren't using the internet before were just suddenly on it. And around that time, it just ramped up hard and more people started participating with it. So more developments happened as far as the internet in general. There was a definite paradigm shift in just how the internet was to what it is now, starting around that era. I think that's why you might get a lot of people like being very nostalgic and talking about things in 2006, 2007, you know? Mm-hmm. How it was so different, but nothing had really changed. Does that make sense, or am I just rambling?
You know, it does make sense, and I can see that. I can. One thing I will say, kind of touching on positives of the internet, because, you know, we've been going back and forth. One thing I really enjoy about the internet as we know it at the moment is the ability to learn from anywhere in the world, especially with like college.
Oh yeah.
Because it's so nice for me as a student to go physically in person to the school for classes that are very hard, hands-on, where I need the assistance. But for classes that I know I can handle myself, to have the flexibility to do that on my own time, anywhere I'd like to do that. My community college has it, Arizona State has it, many, many, many other colleges offer this and universities. And if you play your cards right, not only is it convenient to learn online, but it makes the cost of learning much cheaper. It really does, especially if you're in a position where, say, you've got to take care of a loved one and you can't afford to go away to school, or financial aid's not enough to pay for student housing, you now have the ability, thanks to the internet, thanks to technology today, to still get your education.
Sorry, I didn't realize my microphone was off. As far as classes go, there is a definite difference between attending in person and online. Online, no matter what you do, you have to be very self-motivated to be able to participate in them. They're not something that you can take online and pass with ease. I would actually almost say that attending actual physical classes is easier, because then you are there participating and osmosing information that is not normally provided in the online standardized, classes, like packet work they have. But the general ease of being able to get online credits for free, like you can take courses online through colleges for free now and get credits for them, that is probably going to be the next biggest advent in like us as a society moving forward.
I agree. And given how the price of attending a college or going to university is higher than ever for most people, for most institutions, leveraging this tool will make college affordable again for a lot of people. I personally also feel that, yes, going to college online is in a way harder because, like you said, you have to be self-motivated. I maintained honors, academic honors, while attending my community college, Ivy Tech, going online. But by doing that, I literally had to structure a calendar. I, you know, had a checklist I printed out each week for every class of all the tasks I needed to do, and I planned accordingly. And I always met my due date because I set the due date for myself a day or two earlier than when it was due through the online portal. And if you can be motivated and if you can hold yourself accountable to that schedule, not only will you typically do well in the online class, but you're actually preparing yourself for the real world. Because when you graduate college and you go to work, companies really like to see self-motivated employees and
people who know how to do their own research and learn for themselves. Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
I don't need my handheld for anything. When I work for myself even to this day, and showing up, the client says, okay, I think I need this. I'll do a need assessment, figure out what needs to be done, and boom. They don't have to worry about it because I figure out the rest of the stuff. I get it all handled, and when I come back to them, okay, it's done. That simple.
And that's an important skill to have, but that's not a skill that everybody has or really knows how to get. Like, I am self-motivated to a degree, but when it comes to certain other regards, it's better for me to learn from actual, like, someone speaking to me, someone talking to me about the introduction, about whatever the topic I'm trying to learn is. Otherwise, I might lose interest, I might be distracted, just any number of things occur that I just put it off and put it off. And that's just my own bad habits getting in my way, yes. But, you know, it doesn't hurt to be able to take advantage of resources such as actual hands-on class time, if that's something that definitely helps you.
For me, mathematics is my Achilles heel. So what I do is I take a hybrid approach. I absolutely demand to go in person. I totally do, because having the professor there and the teaching assistant there to lean on to get the help I need to get me unstuck, great. But I follow that up by going to the online portal and by going through Alex or My Math Lab or whatever online portal the school's partnered with. And I myself force myself to take just about every practice exam offered from the math class to better prepare myself. And I found that, you know, when you're at home and you're doing it on the computer and it's just for practice, you know, I'm not afraid then to just go ahead and type in the answer I think it is. And if it's wrong, no big deal. I'm not going to look like an idiot because I'm doing this to a computer. And the computer will kind of say, no, that's wrong, but look at it this way, try it this way. That is the benefit of online learning. It learns as you go. It's intelligent. It can identify where you're weak, and it can structure its learning path to get you where you need to go. So hybrid classes, absolutely, in my opinion, are a wonderful tool for those that typically prefer in-person learning because it supplements and gives you the best of both.
If I get the opportunity to take a class like that, I'll look into it.
Yes. The next thing I really love about internet culture is the thing that most of our listeners absolutely will appreciate, and I think you will as well, Core, and that is online gaming. In terms of not just the silly games, you know, I liked from when I was a Grifflet on AOL, but, you know,
or Farm,
your Xbox console, your, you know, PS2, PS4, Steam, all that stuff that we can do today and competing around the world and find these niche market games from these small development shops that would never be able to be distributed in the 90s business model.
And it's so much easier today. It's all so much easier than it used to be too. Like with Steam, you can just connect and, you know, these games just automatically connect to the servers and you just join with, you know, half a dozen other people. Meanwhile, if you wanted to play co-op games back in, like, you know, early 2000s and 90s and stuff, you would have to get your friend's IP address and enter that in manually and then hope that the connection works and, you know, all your ports were forwarded in the right ways. Now it's all just click and you're there.
Yep. I remember the headaches of trying to get SimCity 2000 network. It was fun when it worked, but holy shit, was it a pain in the ass.
But it would take an hour to get to work.
Literally, that was the game in itself. It's the pre-game warming you up for the game. And, you know, not only that, but even though we've bitched about it before on this show, and I still will bitch about it because I think they should do a better job, but having the ability for a game studio to release a patch to fix bugs in the game can be a great thing, because if something's truly screwing up gameplay that they missed, they can patch that son of a bitch, you download it, boom, your gameplay is fixed, and you can continue to enjoy the game.
There is a fault with that, too, because as we see trending, game designers are now really, really hardcore sticking to their release dates. And, I mean, it's not that they weren't before, but now they'll release a product half polished, half finished, and then just patch it up later. And that's become a really bad habit as far as game design goes.
No, we've touched on that before. Absolutely, I passionately agree with you. I think that aspect is bullshit. There are game companies that, for the physical media, have been caught literally releasing a demo on the disc, and when you insert the disc into your console, it then downloads the rest of the fucking game, which they had to do because of making all the discs get printed and get all the packaging out, etc., to meet the deadline. But it still is not a good experience for the end user. So finding that happy medium, the free market will set the standard eventually when it comes to that. But right now, consumers have been gobbling it up. So, you know, you and I bitch and people will bitch, but as long as we're willing to shell out our cold hard cash to companies like Electronic Arts, well, we just kind of deal with it.
Yeah, you're not wrong. There will be a balance between the consumers and the corporations eventually, where we're just butting heads at this point, so yeah.
The next thing I love about online culture, and I can go on all day, so I'm just trying to hit the biggies to cover this topic. But the next thing I love is the sharing of experiences. And yes, we talked about the negatives that can happen with social networks earlier, but there's so much positive as well. And the things like I really care about is the Indiegogos and sites like that to help people in need for legitimate reasons. Case in point, in Indiana, we had a school shooting, which has sadly become far too common in this country.
Yeah.
But the teacher, in my opinion, is a hero. And because he literally went after the student when the student was firing and waffled this guy. And the teacher got shot 3 times, but because of his actions, nobody died. So there was a Indiegogo.
Sorry.
No, teacher lived.
He did?
Teacher lived. The student that was seriously hurt is alive and is stabilized. And the shooter is in jail right now, and the authorities won't release his name till after charges are filed because he's a juvenile.
That's fantastic.
Yes. And so what did the community do? The community started a GoFundMe, in this case, same thing, for this individual to help cover the teacher's lost wages, medical expenses, etc. And it's up to $80,000.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, there's been cases where there was a bus driver, or no, not a bus driver, a bus driver's assistant that was severely bullied, that was just a loving, caring person. And there was a GoFundMe set up for her. And just being able to, as a community, not only share these stories of wonderful people that need help, or a family that's got a sick child or a sick pet, and, you know, okay, as a community, we're going to help this person. We're going to do a quick fundraiser and boom. And it's, you know, those $5 and $10 donations really add up when you have thousands of people seeing your story and sharing it and
wanting to help. Yeah.
Wanting to help. And, you know, it's not just that too. I mean, we've got it to where now there's GoFundMe type sites for inventors. If you think, wow, you know, so-and-so, this thingamawidget thing, this is going to be the next big thing. I really love this idea. If you agree to send me a prototype, here, I'm going to contribute to your campaign. Here you go. So now even independent little inventors, they don't have to go to a big company to get their gizmo made. They can be crowdfunded. It's fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kickstarter is probably one of the huge advents of what we experience now. Without Kickstarter on its own, a lot of the developments that have occurred on phones, a lot of the developments that have occurred on streaming services would not exist because we didn't realize there was a market for it until someone just happened to say, hey, what do you guys think about this? And off it went.
Yeah, and that is one of the good things about the internet. That is one of the shining examples. The ability to share stories, the ability to share the human factor, whether it's in, you know, someone getting hurt by a natural disaster or when same-sex couples were able to get married. Not just in the United States, but in these other countries as it was legalized one by one and seeing people hugging in the streets and crying in joy as their parliaments and governments passed legislation. All these little things, it's made the world a lot more intimate, a lot smaller. And while, yes, there's a lot of negativity we discussed earlier than about bad things that can happen, it's also a wonderful tool for making us really connect with one another, at least digitally, and realize how the actions of one area or one person can affect so many others.
Yeah, wow.
And yeah, so that's my biggest things about the internet when it comes to that. The last big factor I'll touch on, and I'm sure you can contribute to this, Core, is the ability to save money. In terms of competitive shopping for products, in terms of competitive shopping for automobile insurance, house insurance, renter's insurance, competitive shopping for flight tickets when you want to take a trip to a con somewhere or a vacation in general. The internet has totally changed the way we plan for this stuff to the point that most travel agents have gone out of business. You have the power of the world at your fingertips to save money, to research, to know what you need to do. And I personally go to at least 3 or 4 websites for everything, whether it's for, you know, insurance or vacation, etc., and always comparison shop. And I probably saved thousands of dollars over the years doing that.
I don't doubt. And then there's also the trick of using like VPNs or proxies to bounce off like where you're even looking for like tickets, because if you look for a ticket and you buy a ticket from point A to point B, but you're at a completely different location than either of those, you might find an even lower price. And that to me is just, how do companies get away with that? It's absurd, and it's just unfair business practices.
You say unfair, but I actually understand why they're doing that. If you are an airline, for example, and you have, let's say, an airport that you fly to that's not as busy, and you want to encourage more people to fly on your airline from that airport, it would make sense to put people originating from that airport's tickets at a discount.
Well, no, that's not what I'm saying. So, okay, let me use this as an example. I'm traveling from Salt Lake City to Chicago. Yes. If I, right here, right now, in Salt Lake City, pulled up prices, those prices from Salt Lake City to Chicago, let's say a round-trip flight is going to be $200. Now, if I was to proxy my location and say I was in Texas, but I still wanted to buy a ticket from Salt Lake City to Chicago, that price might have gone down $60. It might be $140 just because my IP address is now located in Texas.
Yep. All location-based pricing.
And that's bullshit.
Core, there's a reason why when my friends from, say, last year, I had my Australian friend came over, it was cheaper for me to buy his ticket for him, even with the exchange rate, than it was for him to buy his ticket in Australia to come over. It's location-based pricing. The airline industry has a bunch of formulas, and in markets and areas where they want to lure business, they will play the game. And in areas where they have plenty of business, they'll set a higher price because they know they can get it. Just like your airline ticket price, literally not only by location changes, Core, but it changes by the minute, depending how busy that flight route is and how full the plane is.
And to me, just as a consumer, that's completely unfair because it makes no sense for someone buying a ticket in Texas from Salt Lake City to Chicago to get it cheaper than it would be here in this scenario. I don't understand why that should be a thing. Because it's usually based off of a supply and demand, but this is just a whole other algorithm that I don't understand. But that's my own personal rant. I don't need to tie up the time just ranting about airlines because I can do that all day.
You're right, but think about this. Because of the advent of the internet and technology, and to a certain extent deregulation within that industry, they now can set up their computer equipment to when we as consumers go online, they can change the price every 30 seconds if they want it. And as long as you're an intelligent consumer like you and I are, and like many of our listeners are, and know how to play the game and know how to check different areas, we can save a lot of money playing the game. It's all about knowing how to play the game. Knowledge is power.
That's not necessarily a good thing, though.
the world we live in.
Well, that's just a matter of fact. At this point, we are an hour in. Do we want to? We did ask for questions, but we kind of did a little bit late, so we only do have one response. But do we want to tackle that one response?
I'd say let's tackle the one response and get one other question from our pool of greatness, if you're up for it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So
you
the
that one
first.
Question the group. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So our first challenge today comes from Eclipse, the most intelligent looking griff in all the land. Love his glasses. The question is, I remember as a young internet user in the 90s that it would be annoyed because it took so long for everyone to submit their moves in a play-by-email role-playing game. Now, I get annoyed when a computer connection hiccups for a minute while playing an online real-time D&D session.
Yeah, no, that's true.
It's amazing how our expectations have changed, because I literally have done exactly what you have done, Eclipse, when I was younger and played by email and such. And, you know, back then, you send an email in, and if someone gets back to you in 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour or two, okay, dial up. It takes time. Now, I get, when I am busy, even text-based role-playing in Telegram, because I don't get a lot of time to do it, so when I do it a couple times a month and I bang out my post, if it takes someone 5 or 10 minutes to start typing a reply to me, it's like, over. Come on, dude. What were you doing?
It may as well be over. I'm not in the mood anymore. Goodbye.
Yeah, it's like I reply as soon as you send to me. Come on. I swear, being able to see when people are replying is almost a double-edged sword because it makes you kind of antsy.
Seeing that typing thing going on and just like seeing it go on for like 4 minutes before they finally send something, just for the love of God. And I'm guilty of it too, I know.
Yeah. That's why there are some people that wish they could turn that off. So, are you ready for the one random question?
Let's take on the one random question. I did just send a poll to the chat itself as a last chance kind of thing. So let's see if anybody replies to that. We'll give that a moment.
Sure.
Oh yeah, what's your one random question?
Okay, my one random question, I literally just had it pulled up, but then I switched back to the chat because you said that. Okay. The one random question is this. It comes from Klinga. And the question is, why do birds in general hate pants so much?
Because they're uncomfortable. They obstruct tail feathers. Our knees don't bend the same way as traditional pants would ask them to. And they're also pointless. Like, the only reason anybody wears pants in the first place is to hide your, like, you know, junk. We have feathers for that. Our crotch fluff keeps us decent.
Speaking from a griffin standpoint, there are some griffs I know that wear large loincloths and etc. that are very similar to pants. But for the most part, pants are quite constricting. And if I'm going to be flying, I'd rather be able to feel the wind passing between my legs and under my tail and all around me in general than being constricted by clothing that causes it to hug tightly against me in places I'd rather be free.
Honestly, yeah, the breeze is nice. But we do actually have some questions now.
Go ahead and pick one.
Okay. Go ahead. I was just going to take on feedies here. The biggest file you downloaded with your super fast internet, and how long did it take? And I'm detecting that super fast internet is a bit
not.
Of, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, when I was on dial-up, I downloaded an 8 gig file. It was some game data. Actually, no, it wasn't game data. It was furry porn. Yes, that's right. It was oh, furry boy. Porn. Right before I finally got DSL, there was this 8 gig thing. It had a bunch of comics and some short animations, and it was great for the time. It took about 2 months.
Jesus. What was this, like via like LimeWire or something?
It was, I used a download manager and...
Okay, I gotcha.
So I could pause it when I had to get off the phone because my mother needed to call somebody. But for the most part, my computer was running connected as much as I could. So
when the pause feature was created, that was a lifesaver. And that didn't come around until probably, what, 2002, 2003?
That's when it became more standard, but my first download manager in 99 had it.
Oh, man. That must have been luxury. I wish I'd known about that. I don't particularly remember what the largest file I ever downloaded was, but I remember this is kind of the peak of Newgrounds. We even had DSL internet, which was better than dial-up, but still kind of dial-up. And the highest speeds you could get at that time was 56 kilobytes per second, kilobits per second. And trying to download a 20 megabyte flash that was, you know, 3 to 5 minutes long would take sometimes a couple hours. Like,
oh yeah,
I would set it up so the flash would start loading. There was one creator that I really liked, did More Like Blue, if anybody ever remembers that. But yeah, his flash animation work was amazing and humor was hilarious. So I would set up these downloads, go do chores for 2 hours, and come back to watch it.
Yep.
And now...
Online video? Any online video in the 90s, that was the case.
I honestly can still sit here, like, still to this day, I can sit here and feel like, whoa, that was fast, when I see, like, 20 megabytes download in 3 seconds or less. Like, to me, that's still just mind-blowing. And I'll have games downloading, like, when I just get a new game or something, and I'll be like, oh, that one's a 12 gigabyte game. Well, that's going to take, like, half an hour. 2 minutes later, it'll be installing, and I'll be like, what the fuck? When did we progress to this point?
So, yeah. Yeah, now they're upgrading my neighborhood to have gigabit internet. So I'm about to get 1 gig per second by the end of the year, and that's going to be fascinating. Because I already think 60 megs per second is fast, so 1 gig is going to be ridiculous.
I would love to live in an area that has that. I'm looking to live in an area that has that, so we'll see.
It's coming. Kenza asked a pretty funny question, and that is, so my question would be, do you remember any horrible virus / malware stories?
LimeWire.
I actually do. Oh, I had LimeWire too. Oh, yeah. LimeWire itself wasn't malware, though. It was what the shit you downloaded on it that would infect your computer.
Yeah, malware wasn't a thing. Trojans were still, like, just a new class. It was just, Trojans were viruses hidden within normal objects, within normal files.
Do you remember the dancing baby from the 90s?
Yes. Yes.
There was, do you remember when people were afraid that it was a virus?
And that was because of, what was that one movie? Independence Day. Because they uploaded the virus to the aliens' Unix mainframe, because somehow the aliens also used Unix. So they uploaded the virus to their mainframe, and it was this repeating GIF. I don't remember exactly what it was. But, you know, people would spoof that, and one of them was the dancing baby.
Yeah, that one, it was funny, because my mother, I downloaded the dancing baby, and my mom freaked out and immediately deleted it. After watching this big news thing on ABC about, oh, it's a virus that's going to go off at a certain time. And it's like, no, it's that's bullshit. But the I guess the worst malware happened right around the time Windows ME came out, and this came back around again for Windows XP, was there was a piece of malware that if it got on your machine, it literally would force your computer to shut down at random times, and you get this pop-up that said Windows was shutting down due to a essential service failure, or sometimes it would say, well, this program has performed an illegal operation and will be shut down, and it would be explorer.exe.
Yeah.
And when you got that, because security software was still in its infancy back in the day, you almost had to just wipe your damn computer to get rid of the damn thing.
There were a few occasions where I had to fully reset my Windows ME, and I just at one point got a whole second hard drive just to keep an image of a fresh image on that hard drive at all times.
Yeah, that was a smart thing to do. It really was. I just got in the habit of reinstalling everything at least once a year. Bad as that sounds,
that on its own was probably just something most people had to do simply out of computer ownership. Like, after a year to 2 years, for whatever reason, you know, Windows XP, Windows ME, Windows 98, 5, they would just kind of self-degrade to the point that their performance was abysmal.
Mm-hmm. Whereas Windows 10, I mean, Windows 7 got better, but in my opinion, Windows 10's got to the point where they think they finally nipped that self-degrading thing in the butt, because it does very good maintenance on the operating system now.
I agree. And even then, when things are starting to feel a little bit like out of whack, it has a refresh feature built in where you refresh, your computer restarts, spends about 10 minutes kind of resorting its files out, and it comes back on, and it works perfectly again. It's nice.
And when you consider how complicated most operating systems, especially Windows, are behind the scenes, it's quite impressive. And last question comes from Bernard, and the question is how long were you allowed online back then? It's a good question.
Like parental limitations kind of thing, I'm guessing?
I'm guessing.
I would be allowed on for like 30 minutes to an hour a day, and then when I got my own laptop, I would sneak on after my parents went to bed. They didn't realize that they could just pick up the phone and hear if, you know, I was on the internet or not.
My Drezel's dad ended up getting so fed up with his sister going online at night doing that very thing that he installed a switch on the phone line, hid it in a part of the house, and before he went to bed, he literally would flip the switch and kill the phone service for the house at night.
I could see that. That would be convenient. Nowadays, we have routers which you can set to automatically turn off or exclude certain computers from being able to use for certain hours of the day. And that's convenient.
Yes. From a parental standpoint, oh yeah, very much so. Though you also got to make sure that, you know, you also have limitations on your kid's smartphone. Otherwise, they can just get around it using that.
Yeah.
But for me, when I was younger,
never doubt how clever a kid can be when they want to get on the internet.
That's right. When I was younger, I was allowed on usually a couple hours at a time. By the time I hit 12, I could be on for many hours without raising suspicion, especially since my parents knew I was playing little games and such. And once I got my own individual, clearly. And when I finally got my own computer to myself, I was hours a day.
Yep.
To the point that when we finally got DSL for the very first time, when AT&T, back when it was Sucks Big Cock SBC, first released DSL in my neighborhood, this giant clunky-ass modem, and it worked half the time. But when they first released it and it finally worked, the fact that two computers were using the internet at the same time was just like mind-fucking-blowing. Oh my god,
yeah. You used to have to have a second phone line in your house to do that.
Yeah, so that was fucking amazing. And then seeing a web page load up faster than the speed of smell. And my first thing I did was went and I looked up Bugs Bunny porn. And it loaded up instantly. And then I looked up Charizard porn. And I was like, wow, I can see Charizard's dick in under 5 minutes. This is nice.
I never had that, like, that mirror flip image. It was always a very progressive thing for me. It started out with like AOL dial-up, and then we moved to DSL, and then we moved to cable, which was not all that fast at the time. Then we did like satellite internet, and probably the biggest flip I had was less than 5 years ago, where I upgraded my parents' internet from 4G, like one of the 4G providers like Clear, to an actual cable service provider, where they were getting like 20 megabits a second capped. Now we're getting like 100 megabits a second capped. That was probably the biggest flip.
Yeah. When I went from my parents to my own Nest for the first time, I went from a 20 megabit, almost 30 megabit connection down to 3 because glorious Frontier Communications. Today, my old Nest that I moved to for the first time still only gets 3 megabit service from Frontier Communications. So when I bought my Nest on the other side of town, I went to Comcast with open arms, and I'm getting 65 megabit service for the same price as Frontier charges for 3 megabit service. So I'm very happy taking my 65 megs over 3. Though where I move next,
evil right now.
Yeah, honestly, Comcast is, when it comes to like customer service, hey, can you help me with XYZ? Compared to Frontier, they're fucking great. Tech will be out same day. At least where I live, it's reliable. I got no complaints. I know other people have had nightmares out the wazoo with them, but at least my little area, it's pretty good.
Yep, I'm definitely one of the nightmare people who become a nightmare bite right back at them.
Mm-hmm. Though I'm not looking forward to the fact that where I might be relocating next because of work, I'm going to have to go back to having satellite, which, for when I'm at home, which is not going to be fun, because while satellite internet now can get 40 megabits per second, it truly can, the latency is still a problem.
Oh, yeah.
So 600 millisecond latency is good on satellite. That's on a good day. So.
Well, I look forward to hearing your robot voice again.
I'll figure out a workaround for recording days. That's yeah. Fine.
Well, okay. Do we want to wrap up?
Yeah, we can wrap up.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. You can catch us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music via the RSS feed, Stitcher, or wherever you buy your podcasts from. But remember, if you're buying this podcast, something's gone horribly wrong. You don't need to pay for this. This is free. We stay free because of supporters like you. You can support us through our Patreon, patreon.com/birdlifepodcast, and as little as a dollar a month really does help. If you enjoy the show, it'll get you access to bonus content as well as, you know, just keep us going, and we really appreciate it. So,
yes.
Thank you for joining us.
Our Patreon allows us to keep the good times rolling. It allows us to invest in better hardware so we sound better for you. And every time you do it, a bird gets extra feathers in its wings.
Yes. And remember, always be beeping.
Always be chirping.
Take on kilts. What's your experience with them?
My take on kilts is they're basically man skirts, and I think skirts are hot. I always have, both on males and females. So a kilt is very appealing to me, and I don't know if you've ever seen a utility kilt, but a utility kilt basically is like the best of shorts and a skirt put together. So if done correctly, it's very attractive, especially in a naughty way. But if you're going to wear one of those around town in the real world, just make sure you're wearing underwear or boxers beneath it. Unless you're about to get jiggy with it, I don't think, as a member of the public, I would appreciate seeing your equipment when you're walking up the stairs inadvertently. Just think of the kids. Put it away.
So
that's all I'm saying.
In that regard, I have a really nice tartare. It's not one of the utility kilts like you're talking about, but it is an actual traditional Scottish, very well-crafted kilt. However, okay, I don't wear it because of exactly what you said. It feels like I'm only wearing a skirt. It doesn't feel like I'm actually wearing anything appropriate or decent. Every time I put it on, I look at myself and I go, yeah, I'm basically wearing a man dress, and I just cannot get over the discomfort that causes. Do you have any advice?
Yes. My advice to you is the same thing I went through when I first switched from wearing briefs to boxers. And that is that if you just wear it, and especially if you wear it and you have boxers or underwear beneath it to give you just another layer of security.
Yeah.
Eventually, if you force yourself to be uncomfortable and go out in it, you'll get used to it. It will become a new normal. And eventually you'll reach a point to where when you go and you wear traditional shorts or pants, if you've been wearing the kilt a lot, it'll feel kind of weird to be that constricted. And it's all what you get used to. It really is. I'm to the point now where I can't wear briefs anymore because I need my twins to hang free. It's all in what you get used to, man. It really is.
I gotcha. I can't get over the fact that when I'm wearing it, it basically looks like I'm wearing a... Okay, it's checkered. So what makes it worse is it kind of has this look of a... Catholic schoolgirl uniform, except different colors. So that doesn't help either.
Yeah, but still.
And I'm not a femmy person, so like I don't feel like I can get away with that comfortably. Like I am more masculine than
Hey, I can understand the concern, but if you meet one of these people wearing a kilt that projects themselves very masculine, they would take that fear away. It's not what you're wearing as much as it is how you're conducting yourself while wearing it. And in your case, you know, you go to some of those Ren fairs and such, try wearing your kilt when you go there. And it can be part of your costume. And you'd be surprised, you'd actually fit in.
Oh, yeah. I won't have any shame wearing it to a Ren fair when that eventually comes around. But I was thinking more of just, you know, for not necessarily everyday wear, but more common wear, more frequent wear.
I will tell you this. When it's very, very hot outside, wearing a kilt really helps keep your lower region from building up a shit ton of sweat because so much air can flow through there.
I don't doubt that for a second.